I'm really honored to introduce our next speaker, Susan Miller. Susan Gilson Miller is professor of history at the University of California, Davis. She is a lifelong scholar of North African history who has taught at Wellesley College, Brandeis University, and Harvard University, where she served as director of the Moroccan Studies program at the Harvard Center for Middle Eastern Studies from 1991 to 2008. Oh, so you can give me some tips on being director of something. Okay. Her research focuses on Islamic urbanism, travel and migration, and minorities in the Muslim world, with a special emphasis on Jewish communities of the North African and Mediterranean region. Susan's talk today is titled, The State of Research of the Shoah, how would you translate that? I don't want to presume.
Holocaust.
The Holocaust in North Africa. Susan, thank you.
Thank you. It's so nice to be here. I've been in Northern California for, this is my eighth year, and I've never been to this beautiful building and this amazing facility, and to get acquainted with the GTU, it's really a pleasure and a privilege, and thank you for the invitation and for organizing this very nice meeting with many people I know, some people that are colleagues, mentors, and Aaron. I'm probably older than he is, but he one time asked me a question 25 years ago at a conference that set me in a direction that kept me busy for a few years. So it's Emily, a student, now a colleague, and Sarah, who's new to the area. It's very nice to see everyone here and all the rest of you. Sarah Levin, who I've known forever and does wonderful work on rural Morocco. And of course, Naomi, that I know by hearsay and by her work on European Jewish studies. So I'm going to talk about the Shoah, which I'm sure we all know the meaning of that, the Hebrew word for Holocaust, the state of research on the Shoah in North Africa. Scholars of Jewish studies agree that scholarship on Sephardim, and I'm going to use that term in the loose, unspecified way, this is not about the term Sephardim, scholarship on Sephardim and the Holocaust is scanty, biased, and deficient. Henry Abramson has written that the persecution of Sephardic Jewry in the Nazi era is under what he calls, and I quote here, a double occlusion. The Shoah is, and he goes on to say, widely understood to be principally a European phenomenon, and Sephardim, especially North African Jews, have been largely ignored when it comes to narrating this most pivotal event in modern Jewish history, perhaps in Jewish history of all times. Of course, the Shoah embraces Sephardim and other places, but my specialty is North Africa, so this is what I'll be addressing here. Moreover, the number of scholars working on the topic of Sephardim during the Holocaust has been minuscule compared with those working on Europe and especially on Eastern Europe. Professor Abramson concludes, and again I quote, hidden from public view and academic attention, the plight of Sephardic Jews during the war has remained understudied and undervalued. And this appears in an article he wrote in Svi Zohar's Sephardi Mizrahi Jewry, for those of you who want to look up the whole article. So when speaking about new directions in Sephardic studies, which is our topic today, I think this one, that of historicizing the Sephardic role in the Holocaust, is really very high on the list of things we need to do. Naturally, there are many dimensions and nuances that come into play when we talk about this topic, and certainly no simple answers. But I'm going to sketch out for you today what I see as some of the aspects of the problem I've encountered in my own research on this topic. And I'm going to begin with a big question. Why this scholarly occlusion, and that's Abramson's word, occlusion of the Sephardic role in the Shoah? Is it really occlusion, as Abramson says, which means to me a kind of impersonal blocking out or closing off, or is it more correctly and more purposefully an occultation, which captures the idea of concealment, obstruction, and exclusivity? That is a conscious effort to remove the Sephardim from this most central event in modern Jewish life. I know this is a provocative proposition, and it's meant to be, and I hope no one's offended, but please hear me out and talk about it. First, let us take note of a few general observations. The majority of scholars of Jewish studies know little or nothing about the Jews of the non-Western world. They don't read or speak languages other than European languages, though they may know modern Hebrew. With few exceptions, they don't know Arabic, Turkish, or Persian, or don't use it in their research. In other words, they do not have the tools for scholarly research in the countries of the Middle East and North Africa, where most of the Sephardim who were victims of the Holocaust live. Most, not all. So they are not equipped on the very basic level to deal with this topic. Even in Israel, or especially in Israel, the gatekeepers to Holocaust learning come out of a European tradition. Institutions like Yad Vashem were founded to preserve and validate a specifically European experience, the destruction of European Jewry, to gather testimonies, to put up a bulwark against Holocaust deniers, to honor the righteous Gentiles, 99.9% of whom are Europeans, and to establish institutions that would preserve the memory of this event for next generations. So let us recall that at its very beginnings, Yad Vashem was meant to be a home for survivors and a repository for their memories and stories, rather than a center for scholarly research. It was some years after its founding that a scientific, in quotes, research arm was added. I don't think it's unreasonable to assert, and I'm not alone in this, that Yad Vashem exists in part to validate Israel's role as guarantor of Jewish survival, that it will happen never again. The memorialization of the Shoah is essential to that mission of Yad Vashem, and furthermore, it's a mission that is closely bound up, I would assert, with both the ideology and the power dynamics of the Jewish state. It goes without saying that memorialization, so far achieved, is built on a solidly European Jewish consciousness. This mindset shapes a particular attitude toward the Sephardim and the Holocaust that results in a treatment of non-Western histories as ancillary to the main story about what was happening in Europe. It's simply an incontrovertible fact that the 6 million were almost all Ashkenazi Jews, and that their terrible fate was not shared by Sephardic Jews, on the whole, who escaped the final solution. Of course, the exception, and Aaron is working on the Jews of Rhodos, who were a blatant exception. Indeed, for many people, both historians and lay people, this fact is the fundamental reason for is a fundamental difference between Ashkenazim and Sephardim in terms of the Holocaust experience. The idea is that Sephardim are eternally excluded from membership in the sacred category of survival. That being said, we ask, and this is my main question today, given this reality, this situation, do Sephardim have anything to do with these events? Any role to play? Is there any way they can make a claim for ownership over them? Well, the good news is there has been an awakening in the last 5 years, I would say, very recently. Traditional Jewish scholars of the Holocaust have woken up to the fact that there are Sephardic histories that are relevant to the grand narrative of the Shoah and have made an effort to tap into recent scholarship on the topic. Let me give you two examples. Last summer, the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, that bastion of Jewish scholarly conservatism, held a conference with the title, it's a long and funny one, Historical Comprehension and Moral Judgment of World War II and the Holocaust, the View from North Africa, Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, and Libya, inviting, and this is key, a small handful of mainly American scholars of Middle Eastern studies who also do Jewish studies, just the very people Emily was talking about, to speak about their research. Another important meeting under the auspices of the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum and UCLA took place in November 2015 in Los Angeles, and it was entitled On the Margins of the Holocaust, Jewish Muslims, Jews, Muslims, and Colonialism in North Africa During the Second World War, and Sarah Stein was one of the major organizers of that conference. Both conferences concerned Sephardim and their role in the Holocaust, and both showcased the scholarship of a younger generation of historians and social scientists dealing directly with the question of the occluded histories of North African Jews during the war. There are other signs of recognition, and let me just talk about them for a moment. Dan Mitchman, who for many years was the doyen of research at Yad Vashem, and was written profusely on many aspects of the Shoah, recently turned to the question of Sephardim and their place in Holocaust historiography. He wrote an article for a collection edited by Chaim Sadun of Yad Ben Tzvi that is not yet published, but I got my hands on a pre-publication copy, which maybe isn't fair, but here goes. The Fate of North African Jews During World War II. Does it belong to the Shoah? This is the title of his article. The Fate of North African Jews During World War II. Does it belong to the Shoah? Question mark. It's worth a few minutes for us to analyze this article, for it tells us a great deal about the state of historiography of this sensitive topic in conservative establishment Jewish studies circles. Mitchman begins by saying, asking, to what extent can North African Jews be considered part of the Shoah? He doesn't mince words. He notes that initially no scholars considered North Africa as part of the Shoah. No scholars. But the years have passed and they have become somewhat integrated. For Mitchman, the crucial question regarding the historical representation of these events is one of genocide. And to what extent North African Jews were included in the final solution. His rather complicated argument unfolds as follows. First, the numbers. According to a protocol presented at the infamous Wannsee Conference of January 1942 that coordinated Nazi actions leading to the genocide, a census was made of the Jews still remaining in Europe. And this census claimed that 700,000 Jews were still in France. An absurdly high number, so high that the German historian Peter Langerich, an expert on the final solution, believes that the Nazis were counting North African Jews. This is Mitchman reporting on this. But other scholars, like Raoul Hilberg, argue that the final solution applied only to the European continent, without explaining the high number, and he explicitly says it does not refer to the Sephardim of North Africa. For Mitchman, the importance of the Nazi census is crucial. Did the Wannsee document include Jews of North Africa or not, is his question. He concludes the numbers are wrong. That, oddly, and he uses the testimony of Eichmann, the world's greatest liar, at his trial in Jerusalem, as evidence to support the contention that this is an error. Eichmann said, "I realize we made mistakes in numbers." So the implication in Mitchman's article, that's the assertion, is that North African Jews were not part of the final solution, and hence, according to the criteria established by Yad Vashem, not really entitled to the status of victims or survivors of a Holocaust. This decision, of course, has very important consequences, not only in regard to the compensation that came to Holocaust victims, but also, and even more important, in terms of memory work and memorialization, as well as membership in that exclusive group of survivors who have a special status in Israel and around the world. Moreover, positivist historians like Mitchman and many other historians of the Shoah, whose life's work is to collect quantitative data on the Shoah to prove its veracity and verifiability, don't usually ask what-if questions. But Mitchman, in this article, does exactly that. What if, he says, what if the German occupation, and this is what he calls it, had been completed? Would the Jews of North Africa have been included in the final solution? Prefacing his answer by saying that historians don't usually deal with the conditional, he concedes that it's quite possible that the Nazi regime would have applied techniques developed in Europe outside its borders if that had been possible. So what do we conclude from this? I would argue that the question of Maccabee Jewish victimhood in the Shoah, if it were left to Yad Vashem scholars, we would not learn very much about their place in Shoah narratology. I base this conclusion on fieldwork. I did this fieldwork on this last summer in Yad Vashem. When I asked by call number for the only dossier I could find in the archives of Yad Vashem relating to the Holocaust in North Africa. And it was dutifully brought to me, and I opened it up, and it was completely empty. I was told that the contents had been transferred to Yad Ben Tzvi. This vacancy in the Yad Vashem cosmos is physically concretized in the exhibition space of Yad Vashem, and I don't know how many of you recently walked through there, where half of one small wall is dedicated to Tunisia, where Jews were in fact deported and Jewish civilians were subjected to forced labor. Nowhere else in this vast exhibition space did I see any reference to the Shoah in North Africa. What do I conclude from this? The principal Israeli institution for memorializing Shoah has turned its back on the question of Sephardic involvement in the Holocaust, relegating it to Sephardi specialists or experts at the underfunded Yad Ben Tzvi, where it remains in custodianship of one scholar and two assistants whose work so far has been limited to creating a website operative in Hebrew, offering a few selected documents. So much for the official solution in Israel, but the story does not end there. From the research point of view, there are some positive signs, as I mentioned, the two conferences. As we all know, there are many different ways of doing history, and the Shoah is a rich topic in constant revision, ready for new methodologies and approaches. Some of these approaches are refreshingly adaptable to research on the Sephardic world, once we put aside the notion that actors in that event must be survivors in the classical sense of the term. Holocaust historian Don Stone is in the forefront of this new thinking. He makes the critical observation that most traditional historiography of the Holocaust, for all its enormity, is dominated by a more or less positivist, that is to say, untheorized empiricist historical method, of which Michman's essay that I already cited is a prime example. Stone proposes a new way of approaching the topic by calling upon historians of the Holocaust to look at a new cultural history for inspiration. What does he mean by this? What is this new cultural history? His idea, and not his alone, there is a whole school of thinking in this way, is that data, historical facts as it were, cannot be considered separate from memory, and that memory is a concrete cultural practice of pivotal importance to Holocaust narratology that embraces wider circles of human experience than that of victimhood identified by traditional scholars. For cultural historians, memory is not only essential, but all memories are equally valid and as a means of making sense of the past, whether they're Sephardi members or Ashkenazi members or whatever. They embrace facts and figures, to be sure, but they also embrace the sentient aspects of historical construction, the feelings, the emotions, self-understanding and understandings and relationships that are behind events and numbers, and consider them also to be the stuff of history. Cultural historians engage in new forms of creativity when it comes to well-known historical phenomena. Think of Simon Schema's work on the French Revolution, or Robert Darnton's work on printing and literacy, or Carlo Ginzburg's quest into the moral universe of a 16th century Italian miller. Taking Stone's argument one step further, I would insist that if we move to this level of engagement with the Holocaust material on the Sephardim, we'll find many, many ways of talking about the Shoah in North Africa and elsewhere that would have meaning and relevance for both scholars and lay people alike without having to argue the case for victimhood, witnessing, or what it means to have survived. I would also argue that using this methodology, we would find multiple points of comparison and crossover with the European experience of the Holocaust, if that is our goal. Racial discrimination, radicalization, prison camps, forced labor, the texture of refugee lives, questions of anti-Semitism and racialization, all aspects of Hitler's Europe are also part of the Sephardic experience in North Africa and elsewhere, but in a very specific way. Unpacking those experiences through ethnographic means, using thick description techniques of cultural anthropologists like Clifford Geertz or the symbolic sensibility of Victor Turner, could open the way to new levels of insight and meaning, just to mention two thinkers whose work is very relevant, I think. Radically altering our understanding of the uniqueness of the North African experience in the context of the Shoah and providing a platform for a specifically Sephardic narrative that can make a reasonable claim for inclusion in the larger picture. Now, my own project on the Shoah in North Africa concerns refugees in Morocco during World War II and the activities of a Moroccan Jewish woman lawyer who was the primary agent for their relief, a person that has disappeared in the historical narrative of the period. I focus on the context, personalities, narratives, and modalities of refugee relief as my larger framework, to answer some questions that really have never been asked. For example, what were the immediate and long-term effects of the encounter between masses of European refugees, mostly Jewish, and local populations? In what ways did this influx of humanity into Morocco, 10,000 or more European refugees by the end of the war, most of them Jewish, affect the quality of Jewish life there, of their relations between Jews and the French colonial administration, Jews and the nationalist movement, the long-term aspirations of Mark and Jewry, how they saw their own future, who were at that time the largest community of Sephardic Jews in the non-Western world. How do we understand the Shoah in North Africa within the context of Muslim-Jewish relations, Mizrahi Ashkenazi relations, Vichy colonial Moroccan colonized relations, East versus West relations, Westerners in this case being the occupying Allied troops after 1942, mostly Americans, and Easterners being indigenous people, both Jews and Muslims. Very briefly, I'll give you an idea of some of the themes I'm dealing with to give you a sense of the richness of this material and the extent to which multiple meanings can be drawn from it that shed light from the periphery, it's true, onto the larger Holocaust narrative. Most of these themes I'll mention, I will discuss in the form of questions, for I'm still wading through masses of primary source material and I really don't have definitive answers, or not any that I'm willing yet to reveal. The first theme is the theme of exclusion, which is familiar to us from the European context, but with its own North African applications. How successful were Vichy officials, the French authorities who were pro-Nazi, in imposing Nazi-inspired race laws in North Africa? We find a replication of many of the steps taken in France, the banning of Jews from public jobs, banishment of children from schools, orders to return to the ghetto. But in North Africa, the fact is these exclusions were achieved with only very limited success. What cultural factors came into play and shaped the specifically North African response to the race laws and vitiated their impact? My own research shows that Vichy made only limited inroads. Native Jews fought back, exercised their traditional access and power. And if one has studied Moroccan Jewry across the centuries, one understands exactly what that means, mobilized their traditional networks, and basically found ways to thwart the most crippling effects of the race laws. The Jewish counterattack, in quotation marks, is evident between the lines of the official documentation and emerges with a certain particular vividness when the documents are read with a sensitivity not only to facts and figures, but also to the texture of relations between native Jews and French officials. To what extent were Jews protected by Muslims? This is a very thorny issue and the source of much error and misunderstanding, and some have even exploited this question in a provocative way, asking the question, were there righteous Muslims, which is very off the mark. The answer is not only in the data, but also depends on a deep reading of Muslim-Jewish relations across time. We discover in the local Moroccan French press that the main tormentors of Moroccan Jews during the war were not Muslim Moroccans, but newly arrived French settlers who saw an opportunity to profit from looting Jewish business. We also see a marked inertia in the French administration to apply these laws because of a culture of co-optation that goes back into the earliest years of the protectorate. Seasoned long-term colonial administrators in Morocco had deep-seated ideas about the importance of Jews in Moroccan society, and they resisted doctrinaire vitiates like Pierre Laval as long as they could. We see a sharp demarcation between what happened in the metropole and what happened in the colony, in the protectorate, based on inherent cultural values. Second thing, community organizing. Here again, I believe the cultural analysis is key. How were Jewish communities traditionally organized? How did their patterns of organization and self-help help them resist Vichy legislation and Vichy aggression? How were Jewish refugees, this great mass of Europeans that suddenly arrived, how were they housed and fed and clothed? Is the stage I use for understanding the topic of Jewish self-help. How local Jews managed to get it together and provide help to these strange Jews from abroad, most of whom knew little or no French, regarded Morocco as a wasteland and considered its local Jews as one step above Bedouins or bush people on the scale of human development. Networking, housing, food, financial help, compassion, religious comfort, and other forms of generosity were qualities that emerged from the local Jewish communities in this crisis. The role of the Joint, of the JDC, and other foreign helping agencies was actually very small at the beginning of the war. It didn't come into play as a serious factor until after 1943. Before that time, the brunt of the refugee crisis fell largely on local Jews. The Ashkenazi-Sephardi encounter in wartime is another arena for rich cultural analysis. In many ways, it foreshadows the disastrous encounter between Ashkenazim and Mizrahi in post-independence Israel. Facts like rampant intermarriage between Ashkenazim and locals, which did take place on many levels, are balanced by culturally laden language that paints a complex picture of how these European Jews who came as refugees mixed and mingled with local society, including Jews, who, it should be noted, were as complex and diversified in education, class, religious sensibility, and worldliness as their Ashkenazi guests. Thirdly, the fear of genocide. As I've already noted, it is often said that Sephardic Jews, and especially the Jews of North Africa, didn't experience genocide and are therefore not really victims, or if they are, they are victims of a different ontological order. While this is no doubt true, it is not to say that they were happy-go-lucky and free of fear, and that the wartime situation was not one a time of trauma, deprivation, and in short, really a nightmare. While genocide, as we define it, did not happen, many Jews reacted as if Germans were coming, and any day. For indeed, they might have come. As American historians Gerhard Weinberg and Norman Gota make claim, they take the view it was indeed Hitler's plan to all along invade North Africa after the defeat of Russia and Great Britain, which, as we know, never happened. The quality of life for both Jews and non-Jews in Morocco living in the shadow of the Nazi threat is a subject that has not really been taken into account. These are just a few of the topics that concern me. Now, to sum up, where does my work fit into the larger picture of learning and teaching about the Holocaust? Here's what I hope to achieve, and others I hope that are also dealing with this topic. First, to join into the project of expanding the geographical and interpretive limits of what we have up to now considered accessible, acceptable, and necessary in Holocaust research. To make the absence of the Sephardic experience into a loss and a vacancy that it's imperative to fill, just as much as the absence of women's experience or the Eastern European experience were once considered unacceptable oversights. This includes not only writing the Sephardim into Holocaust studies, but also recognizing their contribution to the theorizing of the Holocaust experience. This means introducing rituals, symbols, dreams, narratives that are particular to them that emerge from the non-Western matrix into the analysis of what has been up to now an almost exclusively European historical imaginaire. In other words, the recovery of past experience specific to the Sephardic setting should imply a reinterpretation of Holocaust historiography in the present. That is the desired goal. Secondly, the question of memory, which of course is central to this project. I have many testimonies, letters written simultaneously with events, but also witnessing accounts that come after the events they relate, and therefore, in historiographical terms, problematic. A sophisticated literature on memory studies now exists. It should be applied to this material from the Sephardic side as well, and unfortunately, the material is somewhat sparse, but there are many testimonies worth cultivating, and in regard to my work, for example, next week I'm going to Casablanca, where I'm going to be giving a talk to the Jewish community, and I'm hoping that some of the older folks will come forward and tell me their memories and their recollections of the war, and they will be important material for me, I hope. Thirdly, gender studies. My principal character is a woman who's the pivot of my story. Her gender is a critical element because of her professional standing, her role as a caregiver, her role as a mother, as a widow, as the first woman lawyer of modern Morocco, and certainly the first Jewish woman lawyer. Her activities in rescuing were shaped by her gender. Indeed, the role of women as rescuers is a historical genre in and of itself. She reached out to children and families. She used her considerable personal and professional power in ways that make reference to her sensibility as a Sephardic woman. I find this aspect of the research particularly fascinating and unexplored. I'll conclude by saying this is an important new frontier, in my view, in Jewish studies that needs to be crossed. I engage in this work not because of identity politics, I am not Sephardic, or because there's any intrinsic reward waiting for me apart from my own satisfaction as a historian and the thought that perhaps I will have perhaps done my work well. I do it as a seeker of some kind of moral balance, as a message to all those who will listen that the story of the Shoah is far from finished. Thank you.
We have a few minutes for questions or comments for Susan. Aaron.
Thank you for this talk. I think you described very well some of the problems about the integration of this, and what can take it further,
yes,
perhaps, is the curious place that those Sephardic Jews who were subjected to actual genocide, they say the Jews of Greece, of ex-Yugoslavia,
yes.
All of those are always subsumed under something called European history, and also as Greek Jewry or Yugoslav Jewry, but in footnotes in a lot of the Shoah studies is mentioned that they were of Sephardic origin. Now, when for example, in Salonika Jewry is reported and killed en masse in 1943, this is around 50,000 people. This is the largest Sephardic, I mean, it pales in comparison with what's happening in Poland in terms of numbers, but
right.
When we're talking about substantial communities, this really dealt a death blow to Ladino culture, for example, in terms of all of these things. Even there, when we really talk about this, I will mention a little bit about this later on, we're really talking about a Jewry that until 30 years before then had been in the Ottoman Empire since 1492.
Right.
That is to say, it had only 30 years at becoming Greek in a kind of unfinished kind of way. Now, that may or may not matter, and of course there is a kind of a tyranny also of the nation state paradigm,
mm-hmm.
where you chop up all the different Jews, and for example, the case of Libya is extremely interesting because, for example, there, where there is, in fact, a lot of displacement, very brutal conditions with Italian doing all kinds of things, that really is very akin to a lot of things that happen in other parts of the world. But even there, with this nation-state kind of model in
mm-hmm.
Belgrade Jewry, where the Holocaust mm-hmm. took place in the city, is 90% Sephardic, so does it matter? We can ask that question. But does it also not matter? I mean, I think it's a very problematic thing. I mean, how far are we going to go into, this comes from the earlier question, of naturalizing something called
yes.
Greek Jewry,
yes.
when it is really ex-Ottoman Jewry until 30 years before? I mean, what does that mean?
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, there are no easy answers, but there also, somehow, there is an erasure of the
yes.
Sephardic specificity
yes. Yes.
in, even though it's incorporated in the Shoah in Europe, and Raoul Hilberg, for example, in his first major,
yeah.
of course, book, includes in the statistics
yeah.
All of these kind of things. It's kind of like a side issue, because the heart of it is, of course, we can't deny it. I think it's
yeah.
very important to keep that is, of course, Poland and Russia, where the genocide is taking place, but not exclusively. So there is even a further aspect beyond
yeah,
North
sure.
Africa, where
sure.
even in the strictest definition of genocide, there is a Sephardic history,
right.
story, but that is in fact not really in any way incorporated as such into these kind of stories. Now I'm a little uncomfortable about whether we are going to, I mean, I'm not uncomfortable, but I see all the problems about saying, oh, but the Sephardim were also part of the Holocaust, because, of course, they were. But I'm not sure exactly whether this is really on purpose, as you started at the very beginning, or is it other long-standing blind spots that kind of continue
mm-hmm.
through the modern period?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's probably the latter. But then, may have a better perspective on this by now, but I just think that we have to ask the question, like, why is it because, in fact, a lot of the history of these areas had not been done before, not integrated, therefore, by extension, even the Shoah, when it arrives in different
mm-hmm.
forms,
mm-hmm.
cannot be seen, or is there something else going on? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is really a big question.
It's a good question. I mean, if I was counting on you, of course, to bring up this aspect of the more global history, which you and Sarah both have worked on, I don't really know that much about. My sense is, Aaron, that we that as historians of the non-Western world, we don't play by the same rules. That we don't have to accept the paradigms that have been created in Eurocentric places. I feel that we have the tools and the approach, and the more that we find the material, the ammunition, to make a claim on a kind of narratology that is very specific to our places of intellectual engagement, that we don't have to accept. I mean, the rules and the regulations that have been created among European historians in a very specific place in the context of the institutions in Israel that have been the path breakers in doing Holocaust histories. I must say that the United States Holocaust Museum, although in many ways is a home for Europeanist thinking, is also understanding the necessity for widening the net and accepting the possibility of different kinds of narratives that arise from different assumptions. And of course, localism is essential to understanding our parts of the world. That the nation state is an important factor, but it's a new thing. And the local inclinations, the communities, the small villages, the cities, the way that people experienced this crisis and others is so much determined by place where. And until we can get that across, we really are not going to be succeeding altogether. But thank you, it's absolutely true. My answer is we needn't play by the rules.
I think we have time for two more comments. So Emily and Danielle, if that's okay.
Sure. So given what you just said, Susan, about not needing to fall into these paradigms of Eurocentric paradigms, why do you want so badly into this club? I mean, why? I mean, I know you, but I mean, why should we? Why should we, as non-Western historians, fall in? I mean, I'm being a little provocative on purpose here, but
mm-hmm.
you know, the Shoah is so definitive of European Jewish
uh-huh.
history and American Jewish identity, even
yeah.
at this point, it's almost a fetish. And so why, I mean, yes, I'm all for reconstructing history and recovering past experiences, but is this really, you know, it almost reminds me of, you know, you go in Morocco today, the rabbis are dressing like Hasidim. It's like, what, you know, this is something that they want, in order to be real Jews, they have to look like Polish people.
Right.
What, do we need that experience to legitimate Moroccan history?
Well,
I mean,
you know, if you don't have a sense of your own past, you really don't have a future.
But they, okay, but that's one, I would say, small part of the past? I don't know.
I don't know if it's
a
small part. It's a small part. It's a part of the past that's been utterly neglected for a variety of reasons. You know, the Moroccan historians don't talk about this. They're not interested in the Shoah. If when they talk about the war, they talk about it in two paragraphs about what happened to the Nationalist Party.
Mm-hmm.
They don't write about what happened, with some exceptions.
Mm-hmm.
This is a Jewish story that's been occulted, in my view.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to come to the surface. There are hundreds of thousands of Moroccan Jews around the world whose parents experienced this,
mm-hmm.
or grandparents. But for them, it's a hole, it's a vacancy, it's a vide.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel it's a not only my own, but other people as well. Moroccan historians feel it's a moral obligation to tell the story as it was enacted.
One more comment.
It's actually more about
that.
She's
like,
go ahead. So this is Demetria Yunush, but I'm curious. So there was a book written a few years ago. I can't remember the name of the scholar. She's a German woman. And she wrote about the Turkish Jewish experience of the Holocaust.
Oh, yes, yes. I know I sat next to her at the Holocaust Museum for 4 months. But
from San Diego.
No.
Corey
Goldstein. Yes,
exactly.
Yes.
So she talks about how, in part, how there were, you know, several thousand Turkish Jews living in Europe, the place mostly France, and due to like willful neglect on the part of Turkish officials,
yes.
the officials in,
yes.
In France at the time,
right.
they lose their Turkish citizenship.
Right, and they were killed.
Stateless.
Yeah.
I'm curious if you have similar examples.
No.
I don't know much about this, but
no, I do not. Look, there's a myth that has wide circulation that the king of Morocco, who wasn't the king then, he was a sultan, was the savior of the Jews. And this has become embedded in contemporary Moroccan discourse, that Sultan Mohammed V was the savior of the Jews, kind of like a Danish, you know, a Moroccan Danish king. This is an absolute...
Which is also...
This is absolute nonsense. The king at the time, the Sultan, was a puppet of the French. He had as much political authority as I have, you know, as I do. However, he did have moral authority over the mechanisms, the traditional mechanisms of the state, and there was, as far as I can tell, I have to dig further, but there was very little collusion between the monarchy and the French officials who came after 1941. We have to take this story very carefully, step by step, because there were changes within French officialdom in Morocco as Vichy became more and more entrenched and as certain Vichyites took over. But the Moroccans did not themselves promote persecution of the Jews. There were some hungry people around the edges that may have taken advantage. But the main, as I said, the main persecutors were French settlers who were far right. That came from France with the far-right sentiments and the traditional French anti-Semitism. It's not to say that anti-Jewish feeling does not exist in Morocco. It does, but it's not European anti-Semitism. It's based on different assumptions and different ways of operating. And the idea of genocide just would not happen.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you.